All right, chapter 14 then, and if you'll begin reading, let's start with verse 51 again in chapter 13, and read down through the first seven or so verses in chapter 14. It happened, they shook off the dust from their feet against them, came to Iconium. The disciples were filled with joy in the Holy Spirit. It happened in Iconium that they went together to the synagogue of the Jews and spoke that a great multitude of both Jews and Greeks believed. So we see a very similar pattern emerging through the efforts in this first missionary journey. But again, the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Therefore they stayed there a long time, speaking boldly in the Lord, who was bearing witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the multitude of the city was divided. Part sided with the Jews and part with the apostles. And when a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and Jews with the rulers to abuse and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding region, and were preaching the gospel there. So we have Iconium, then we have Derbe and Lystra that are mentioned. But let's spend just a few moments, first of all, talking about the preaching in Lycaonium. Now again, I have up here on the slide, the same slide that began our study of chapter 13 as we began the missionary journey, just so as the journey continues to remember these things, that first missionary journey that we're covering in the material from Acts 13 to the end of Acts 14, came after Herod's death in AD 44, which is related in the 12th chapter. And so we're giving the date of that journey, approximately AD 45 through 48. And it is during that time that the Galatian churches were established. We're actually talking about that here in this section of our study. And at the close of the tour, as we'll relate in the latter part of this chapter, Paul and Barnabas report back to the church in Antioch of Syria. Now, where we are now is at Iconium, where Paul and Barnabas begins to speak in the synagogue. And here is the map. And again, so you'll note that they left Antioch and Pisidia and went to the village, which was a major village of Iconium, major in the sense, in looking at the board again, that it was the location of several Roman roads, and so it was an important area with regard to travel, kind of a central area with regard to the intersection of several roads. But Iconium is about 60 miles southwest of Antioch and Pisidia, in the region of Phrygia, near the border of Phrygia and Lycaonia. And the reason why we say it's near the border, because as they go through Iconium into Lystra and Derbe, Lystra and Derbe are in Lycaonia. So there's only about 20 miles difference between, or 20 miles separating Iconium and Lystra. So it was a fairly important travel city in the sense that there were several Roman roads that intersected there, and an obvious place for Paul and Barnabas to stop at on their road to preaching. So they go from Antioch of Pisidia to Iconium. Now, as we have read, the message that was preached by Paul in the synagogue and Barnabas here, as they spoke to the synagogue of the Jews, was a successful message. We know that because we're told that a great multitude of the Jews and of the Greeks believed. But, having said that, verse 2, there were unbelieving Jews that were there as well, and Gentiles. So you have, and it's, you know, the case everywhere you go. You preach the gospel, some believe, some don't. But we can indicate again the successful nature of this. Now, we've actually touched on this. I think we mentioned it last week, and I don't want to state it so often that it becomes burdensome. But what I do want you to recognize is that the Apostle Paul and his companions were not concerned about the reaction to the preaching. And I don't mean by that that they didn't care whether individuals believed. They certainly did. But they did not modify. They didn't seek to mollify. They didn't seek to soften in any way the preaching of the message in order to become less offensive. That's what I mean by that. They never did that. It never was done. And we've actually touched on this not only in the Bible class yesterday, but I've preached lessons on it recently. The fact that as you preach the gospel, as a result of that, preaching of the gospel of Christ, you will always cause yourself to become an enemy to some. And that is because, you remember we mentioned this last week, the light and the darkness, that the light is of course, Jesus Christ is the light of the world. The light represents the gospel of our Lord and the preaching of truth. But men hate the darkness because their deeds, or excuse me, men in the darkness hate the light because the deeds that they do are exposed by the light. And so there is conflict, always conflict, always will be conflict. And I am afraid that in our day and time, individuals are too concerned with how preaching will be perceived in the community, how the church will be perceived in the community. The fact that it is a bad thing to be making enemies by what you say. And you know, as do I, that there are those types of concerns. We want to have a good name in the community, that type of thing. Well, Paul and Barnabas never had a concern about that. Because they recognized, especially in such polarizing times in which they lived, that there would be individuals, as a result of the preaching, that would hate them, literally hate them. And when you look at the language that is contained in this text, notice verse 2. The unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. They poisoned their minds. And then verse 4, the multitude of the city was divided. And you've got two parts. And I don't know how equal the parts were, but you had a portion of the city that was defending the apostles and the doctrine they taught, accepting of the truth of the gospel. Then you had those who were violently opposed to the preaching of truth. And everywhere you go where the gospel's preached, that's going to be the case. So what should we do in our community? We should boldly preach the word, in full recognition that if we do that, there will be some who will oppose us, some who will be angry at us. And again, that's the nature of the gospel. And let me just give you an example as we parallel it. Most of the denominations that exist, for example, in the city of River Oaks, do not teach the truth with regard to God's plan of salvation for man. As such, because they're not teaching the truth in that matter, they're leading individuals astray, giving false hope to individuals who have not responded to the gospel of Christ, leading them to believe that they're safe when they are not. So what are we supposed to do about it? We're supposed to preach the truth. Now, when we do that, individuals in those churches are going to oppose us and become angry. How dare we would say that some in their number, those that they have taught, are not saved. They're lost because they've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ. They're believers in Jesus Christ. They're saved. How dare we say they're not? And they become angry as a result of it. But it's our responsibility to preach the truth. Same thing could be said with regard to worship. The majority of the religious groups, and again, we can make note not only of Christian denominations, and I use again the term in an accommodated way, but these various denominations who claim to be following Christ, but are teaching religious error. We can equate it to that parallel, but we also can make note of those of other religions that exist in our community, the Muslims, the Jews, and others. Those Eastern religions as such. But these individuals, they all claim that they are right, claim that they are acceptable, claim that their path is one that leads to righteousness, but the claims are false. Now, if we preach the truth and we expose that error, we expose the false worship that is offered up in the various denominations, we expose the fallacy of denominational thinking itself, all of those types of things become something that is polarizing. Some people are going to hate us for it. And some people don't have a stomach for that. They don't want to be hated. They don't want to be severely opposed. And there are some churches that are unwilling to preach the truth, the unadorned gospel of Jesus Christ, because of their concern about how they're perceived by the community. Well, again, you can't be worried about that. All you can do is preach the truth. And if individuals are responsive to the gospel of Jesus Christ, then they will gladly accept it. If they are not, they will oppose it. Some will be a bit more strong in their reactions to it, but it's going to be opposed. If you preach the truth, some are going to be unhappy about it, and you can't concern yourself with that. Now, I'm not saying that you strive to be antagonistic. That's not the point of this, and I don't think Paul did. I think that we can see, as we look at Antioch and Pisidia, the response initially to the gospel and such that there was nothing about it. I mean, you remember the Jews in the synagogue asked them to speak, asked them to talk to them, and Paul and Barnabas did as they were asked, but they were playing and preaching the gospel. And it was not until the Jews came to this understanding that their message, the message that Paul and Barnabas was bringing, was something that could cause them to lose their standing or for some other reason they rejected it, that Paul said, "You have judged yourself unworthy of everlasting life." And he spoke very, very plainly in his denunciation of their unbelief and their rebellion. But everywhere he went, he was opposed, often was persecuted. Here in this particular case, we are told in verse 5 that a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to abuse and stone them. So here was a case where there was an attempt made to stone them, and they, on that particular, escaped that attempt. And we'll see on other occasions and other places where he was not quite as fortunate to escape the actual persecution. But again, the fact that the results were mixed does not in any way mitigate the statement that the message itself was successful, because there were many individuals who believed as a result of their preaching. Okay. The results, as we have alluded to a number of times already in our study as to why or why not an individual's response to the gospel, is less dependent upon the message itself, more dependent upon the heart of the hearer. Same message, heard by two different individuals. One became angry at Paul, the other received it and accepted it. So it is not dependent upon the message. The message is the same. It's dependent upon the heart of the hearer. Okay, anybody have any statements concerning those first introductory thoughts in this section? Yes, Justin.
I find it interesting how those opposing Paul and Barnabas, I suppose, change their tactics as things go along. They're first in Antioch, which is a fairly large place, and they're going to the chiefs and to the prominent and devout women and to the chief men of the city. And that was the tactic that was taken often in Jerusalem, which is also another large city. Because they went there and said, "Hey, look, these people are threatening your power." And I'd used that tongue-in-cheek to talk against big cities before. But you go on down to Iconium, which was, it was a crossroads, so it wasn't a big city, but it was a fairly big place. And they had to make it more generic. They had to go to the Gentiles in that case. And then you see here in a moment, they go down to Lystra and Derbe, and they're just along one of the roads that goes through Iconium, so they're even smaller.
Yeah.
And they're not even discerning there. No, there's not even a rebellion there. They actually come from Iconium to Antioch down there, and then it says they talk to the multitudes. They don't even care who they're talking to. They're talking to anyone that will listen and oppose them, because they know that if it starts growing in these small towns, it's going to come back their direction too.
Yeah.
It's all so contrived and self-serving.
Yeah, yeah. That's I think that's the word that I would use with regard to the efforts on the part of these individuals. And one of the things that separates those who are righteous from those who are seeking unrighteous goals is the fact that those who are truly righteous will not resort to the politicking and the contrivances and the methodology of going behind the scenes or trying to bring up support. You read about that time and time again. Those who do not have the truth are those who seek to do that. In the way that they're opposing. So contrived is a good thing. Let's go to this place. And again, the fomenting of strife by the outsiders. He alluded just a moment ago, you'll notice in Acts 14 and verse 19, it's just a little bit ahead, we mentioned how that they escaped from Iconium without being stoned, but it's only 20 miles away as they went down to Lystra. And we're told that Jews from Antioch and Iconium, not only Iconium, but 60 miles away, all the way from Antioch, pursued Paul and Barnabas there. And they came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. So they were able to stone Paul on that occasion and almost killed him. But we have individuals coming from outside, and that's what they're doing. What can we do? Who can we tell? Who can we pursue and recruit to get them on our side so that we can stop this? And it's not a matter of a open-minded study of God's word to determine what truth is. These are carnal tactics and attempts to curry the favor of the people and maintain power or maintain standing. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I'm afraid that those things can be present. The same tactic can be present. For example, a local church. You have a group of Christians and perhaps a dispute arises with regard to what God's Word teaches. What are you supposed to do? Well, if a situation like that arises, then what you're supposed to do is open up the Bible and study. Determine what truth is and all submit to the truth of God's Word. But often what happens instead is that efforts are made to curry favor, recruitment, the taking of sides. You'll remember, for example, in Corinth that kind of was present with regard to the favorite teachers. How can we get the majority? How can we get rid of the others? And instead of having this idea of let's studying and let's come to a knowledge of the truth and let's all speak the same mind and the same judgment, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that Paul admonishes, there's this sectarian mindset as it's us against them and we need to expunge them. That type of thinking is just horrific, but I've seen it in many churches. And again, with regard to tactics such as that, although we find here the apostles were not certainly guilty of these things, the unbelievers were. Just because you hold to a particular doctrine as being true, that doesn't mean that you cannot be guilty of fomenting strife by the use of subversive and ungodly tactics, even in the pursuit of your particular position, if it be true. The fact is, we must preach the truth, we must act as Christians, act in love, and these kinds of things are characteristic of Jews and ought not to be characteristic of us, characteristic of these individuals of prominence and ought not to be characteristic of us. What we ought to do is to be wise as serpents, certainly, but harmless as doves. It's such an unpleasant and an ugly thing to see how Paul was treated here on this occasion. As the preaching goes on, these individuals are simply concerned with what's being taught, and because of how it impacts them, because their standing as leaders in the community, perhaps in their minds, is being attacked or in danger of being lost, and as a result of that, they're going to do anything, even resorting to murder, as we see there in chapter 14, verse 19, to keep this from being taught. Not any concern at all with regard to whether it's true or not. It's simply a desire to maintain their standing. But again, notice the results were mixed on this particular occasion. And it seemed to be that there were many believers, but there were many who were virulently opposed to it. Okay, now in verses 3 and 5, we are told, despite the fact that there was a great deal of division, in verse 3, that they stayed there a long time. And they spoke boldly. But notice this. And again, this I think is a significant sign with regard to the lack of honesty in the hearts of those who were listening, who opposed Paul and Barnabas, because the preaching that was done on that occasion boldly was accompanied by blessings from God. Notice we're told that they spoke boldly in the Lord, who was bearing witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So it was not only the message preached, but there was the divine demonstration that the message was from God that was given through the signs and wonders that were being accomplished. So Paul and Barnabas were not just arguing and debating the issue. They were showing that the message they were preaching had God's divine acceptance by the signs and the wonders they performed. So they were having to resist not only the word, but resisting the evidence that was given through the miracles that the word was from God. And again, it's not a matter, and it often isn't a matter, as to whether an individual can be convinced or not. You know, you hear that these days too. You preach the gospel, well, I just was raised differently than you, or we just interpret it in a different way, or we see it differently. The truth is the truth. And ultimately what it comes down to is people reject the truth. And they have various reasons for doing it. But it's because their hearts are not honest that they do it. And because anyone who has an honest heart will be receptive to the truth. If you read Mark 16:16, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved, he that believes not shall be condemned. An honest heart, no matter how simple-minded an individual may be, is able to understand the truth of that text. And individuals who are not willing, it's not because of anything other than they are closing their minds to the truth. Now you may have to get over a lot to get to that, but it ultimately comes down to that, to whether a heart is open or not. On this particular occasion, there was plenty of evidence supplied by God Himself that the words that were spoken were the words of God. They were inspired. They were from Him. And yet, even in the face of those divine demonstrations, they still refused to accept it. And so the multitude of the city was divided. But I do want to make note of the fact that that Paul and Barnabas did not leave the city of Iconium quickly. We're told in verse 3 that they stayed there a long time. Now, it's an indeterminate statement, but it does indicate that it was not a hit-and-run type thing, and it was not until they were driven out of the city that they left. So they preached there for a long while, had an opportunity, I'm sure, as a result of that, to establish the brethren in the faith. But ultimately, the plot was hatched, as indicated in verse 5, to stone them. And when they found out about the plot, they left Iconium and went to Lystra. Okay, anybody have any comments or questions about the time spent there in the city of Iconium? All right, making good progress then. I did want to make note of the text of Matthew chapter 10. I meant to apologize for the fact that I didn't do this exactly right, but I wanted you to notice that the city was divided as a result of the preaching. We already made note of the fact that the gospel does divide, but I did have the text of Matthew chapter 10 that I wanted to use as an example. When the promise was given by Jesus there in chapter 10 and verse 34, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. So it's not surprising, since Jesus came not to bring peace, but rather a sword, that the preaching of his gospel would divide a city. Now, wait a second, aren't we to preach the gospel of peace? Yes, the gospel brings peace with God, but often because of the unwillingness of individuals to receive it, it does not bring peace at all with individuals in the world. But rather it brings division with individuals in the world. And so there is no contradiction between those passages or those concepts. One has reference to the fact that we have reconciliation with God. The other is that realization that the message, as it is preached, will bring conflict. It always will. It's inevitable. We should not shy from that nor apologize when we preach the truth and it leads to individuals being offended or antagonistic toward us. That's just inevitable if we're indeed standing for what's true. So, with that in mind, we go now to the city of Lystra. I thought that I was going to make Lystra big. Maybe that's next. Yes, there. Lystra, again, is located about 18 miles south of Iconium. Derbe is in that area as well. They're both cities of Lycaonia. Derbe is about 20 miles southeast of Lystra. As I was reading about these particular cities, we note a couple of things. First of all, we're talking about small communities here. In fact, so small, there's no record of them, either of these cities, having a synagogue. We've been noting that everywhere that the Apostle Paul went, that he preached first in the synagogues. Well, there's no indication that these little communities of Lystra and Derbe even had synagogues. Of the two, Lystra was the more significant town, but again, these are small communities in desolate regions, and so the people are simple. And I think, as Justin indicated in his analysis of this progress with regard to the persecution, that it's very valid to point out that we are going from an urban region, although I wouldn't necessarily say Antioch City was urban in the sense of big city, but a more important city now to just small villages. And it's interesting indeed to note the way in which the progression of the persecution took place, as he alluded to, as you went to those places. Lystra then is the next location, and the account there begins in verse 8. And what is significant about that account is two things. Number one, the healing of a crippled man there in the city. And number two, the response of the city to that healing. So if you'll note beginning of verse 8, we'll read verses 8 through 18. That'll be probably about all the time that we'll have for our discussion. But I do want to just make note of it very quickly. In Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb. He had never walked. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet." And he leaped and walked. Now when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lycaonian language, and I'm mispronouncing this according to it, it's Lycaonian, Lycaonian language. "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men, and Barnabas they called Zeus, Paul they called Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of their city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness.' And with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them." Now, we read in verse 19 a little bit earlier that after this, the Jews from Antioch and Iconium came and stoned Paul and drug him out of the city. And the next day he went to Derbe after he had been revived. But verses 8 through 18 cover the significant events in the city of Lystra. So next week we'll begin discussing the healing of the cripple. One thing to, I would like you to read it and study it. One thing to make note of is the instantaneous nature of the miracle. We'll talk about that a little bit. And then, and perhaps more importantly, the response of the superstitious Lystrians to that particular healing, and the message of Paul as he sought to explain to them. Very, very similar to, for example, his address on Mars Hill. In Acts chapter 17, there are allusions to certain things that are taught by the Apostle Paul in Romans 1. So this was a message that he proclaimed on a number of different occasions with regard to the testimony of God in nature, but the fact that they should not be worshiping idols, which he refers to as useless things, but rather give their attention to God himself. And so we'll address those things. But the final thing to note in Acts 14 and verse 18 of the text, just want you to note that even with these statements, that they could scarcely restrain them from worshiping them. Superstition is a very strong thing. It's very strong. It's very difficult to overcome. And I wanted to address that a little bit in our discussion next week as well. So keep those things in mind. Take the time to read the entirety of the 14th chapter. Study especially verses 8 through 18, because we'll have our time to discuss those things in our discussion next week. But that's where we'll pick up. Acts 14 and verse 8. All right, thank you very much for your kind attention today, and we'll pick up there next time.